Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this earth. It's a report from man's farthest frontier, the radio signal transmitted by the Soviet Sputnik, the first man-made satellite as it passed over New York earlier today.
You are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show. I'm Charlie. I'm in the studio with just everybody, so I'm not going to list any names. I'm just going to say it's the crew, and it's Friday. Can we all get a happy Friday yay out of everybody?
Happy Friday!
Fantastic. Each week on Lost in the Stacks, we pick a theme and then use it to create a mix of music and library talk, whichever you're here for. We hope you dig it.
Our show today is called Peer Review and the Cold War.
I'm sorry? What was that?
What did one have to do with the other?
Well, in October of 1957, the Soviet Union launched the first artificial satellite into orbit, resulting 60 years later in the academic peer review system we now use in scholarly publishing.
Wendy, do you think there might have been some other consequences too?
Threading that narrative together for us will be today's guest, Melinda Baldwin, a historian and an expert in the history of how scientists communicate research.
If you want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is Lits418 for Lost in the Stacks, episode 418. Feel free to tweet your thoughts, questions, or your peer review experiences with that hashtag.
Reviewer3.
Oh, Reviewer3 is the worst.
Our songs today are about the Cold War, simpler times, and increasing complexity and accountability. Let's kick off with a song about the one event that spawned the space race between two Cold War superpowers. This is Sputnik by Mum Runner, right here on Lost in the Stacks. Mum Runner.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and joining us online is Dr. Melinda Baldwin, a science historian and a senior editor at the publication Physics Today. Melinda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you work for a scholarly society. The American Institute of Physics publishes the publication that you edit, Physics Today, and they publish a great deal of science. And your particular work is looking at the history of scientific publication, because you're a historian. Your educational background is in history. I think you've got a PhD from Princeton. Is that right?
Yes.
So I wonder what led you to the world in your history studies to led you to the world of how science gets published and how it gets communicated.
So I think that my interest in scientific journals actually dates back to a job I had in high school. I was working at the university library at the Colorado School of Mines over the summer, and it was my job to pick up all of the journals that people were using and to log which ones were used so we could decide which ones we were going to resubscribe to, and then I had to put them all back on the shelves. So I just got to handle a lot of bound journals as physical objects. And I became really interested in what people were reading, why they were using this kind of publication. And so when I went on to become interested in the history of science, I became very interested in exactly how that genre of the scientific journal had developed. And eventually I wrote my dissertation and then my first book on the history of Nature, one of the world's most competitive and influential scientific journals.
Would you say it's probably the most important scientific journal? Just your opinion.
Well, I don't want to step on any toes at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which publishes Science.
Oh,
but
okay, right.
That's I would certainly say it's one of the top three. I think Science, Nature, and Cell are generally thought to sort of occupy that upper echelon.
So why is Nature and its American counterpart, Science, and other journals like Cell, why are they so important to scientific scholarly communication?
I think there are a couple of different reasons. For Science and Nature, one of the really unique features of those kinds of publications is that they're not devoted to a specific scientific discipline. They don't just do physics. They don't just do biology. They aim to publish exciting research from kind of across the spectrum of scientific work. And so if you're, say, a biologist and you get your paper published in Nature, that means that it's not just of interest to people in your subfield of biology. It's not just of interest to other biologists. It's so important that everyone working in the sciences or everyone interested in the sciences should be reading it. That's kind of the perceived judgment on the importance of the science that gets published in those journals. The other thing about Nature and Science is that they include news coverage and commentary. And part of what I argue in the book is that one big reason that Nature became so influential in Britain and then later for a worldwide audience was that those commentary and news columns were a venue where scientific researchers could talk about what science was and what it meant to be a scientist. They made Nature essential reading in a way that competing publications like the Philosophical Magazine weren't necessarily able to do.
So that's interesting. I didn't realize that. It was really the commentary and the news aspect of Nature that made it indispensable. I would have assumed that it was the peer-reviewed science that was, I guess, in the way it's been presented to me, is like the cream of the crop, the most important of the most important.
Yeah, I really think that what set Nature apart in its first years was that news and commentary, was the ability, for example, to communicate and hold scientific debates in the letters to the editor. And there are some really heated discussions that happen in the early letters to the editor. Some things that I think would kind of shock a modern reader if they read it. You know, venerable men of science calling each other names and insulting each other's manhood. That was the kind of thing that got published in the early letters to the editor. But it was a really important service that Nature offered to its readers, the ability to write to Nature's letters to the editor, have your letter published that week, and then get a reply from the person you were debating with, you know, way on the other side of the British Isles, the very next week.
So this is commentary on articles. The news and commentary was it about the articles that were like the original peer-reviewed science that was published in Nature?
Yeah. So some of the letters were about things that had been published in Nature, but oftentimes one really interesting thing that happened in the 19th century is that scientific researchers started writing about things that they had read in other places to Nature. So they would write to Nature to say, I just read this article in the Fortnightly Review and it's terrible. And so scientific controversy started to get redirected to Nature, and it was because it was this weekly magazine that had such a fast turnaround time for publication. The other thing I should say is that for this early period of Nature, for the 19th century, the science in it was not peer-reviewed in the way that we understand. It was vetted by editors. Norman Lockyer, the first editor of Nature, was an astronomer. He had some assistants who worked in the biological sciences at different points. But none of the articles that would have been published in 19th century Nature were ever sent out for anonymous external reviews by two or three referees the way they would have been today.
So it was just assumed, I'm guessing, it's just assumed then that because the scientists who were submitting the work and who were submitting these letters and commentary, because they were scientists and qualified, they were just trusted. It was trusted that they had done a good job and had followed the scientific method properly.
Yeah, there was a lot of trust placed in the contributors not just to Nature. I should say that in the 19th century, it would have been far more common to run a journal in the way I was describing than to actually use referees. The journals that did tend to use referees were often ones like the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society or other journals that were affiliated with the scholarly society. And there, it wasn't so much about a lack of trust in the people who were submitting articles. It was more about the desire to make sure that everything the society was publishing was a credit to them. And it also helped provide the editor some cover if a member of the Royal Society submitted a paper that the editor thought wasn't very good. Reaching out to other experts in the field to say, can you give me your opinion on this, gave the editor a little bit of backing if he needed to write back and say, we're not able to print this in the Philosophical Transactions at this time.
So just in about the minute or so that we have left in this segment, is that how peer review, as we know it today, which is, you know, colleagues and peers of scientists, you know, reviewing work anonymously, was that the first step of evolving to how it got to where it is today?
I would say that yes, that the 19th century is really where we start seeing the first external refereeing systems. But in the sense of peer review being something that absolutely has to happen before your science is taken seriously, in the sense of peer review being kind of the arbiter of scientific authenticity, that's a phenomenon that happens much later, but I hope we'll talk about that later in the interview.
And we are speaking with Melinda Baldwin. She is senior editor at Physics Today and also a science historian, and we're going to be back with more about peer review and how the Cold War snuck into that development after a music set.
File the set under Q1.N2Bob. Just heard American Song by the Pointy Sticks. Before that was The Russians Are Coming by A.D. 1984. Those are some songs about the cultural effects of the Cold War.
Welcome back. On today's Lost in the Stacks, we are talking to Melinda Baldwin about her work looking into the history of scientific scholarly communication. So we talked a little bit about the history of how peer review developed in the late 19th century into the early 20th century. I think it's fair to say that peer review has not always been as important to scientific publishing as it is now. Can you talk a little bit about how that dynamic in peer review shifted once the Soviet Union launched Sputnik?
So after the launch of Sputnik in the U.S., there was a lot of feeling in the United States that the Soviets were ahead of the Americans when it came to science and technology. The thing is that the launch of Sputnik happened during the International Geophysical Year, and the Americans had announced their intention to put a satellite into orbit for IGY. And when the Soviets announced that they were going to do the same thing, the Americans thought that the Soviets were just boasting. They didn't really take that claim seriously. And so there was a lot of shock and kind of consternation when the Soviets were the first to put a satellite into orbit. So American spending on science had already been massively increasing during the post-war period. But after the launch of Sputnik, for example, the National Science Foundation budget just absolutely blew up. If you look at a graph of NSF funding, there's a huge peak that happens right after Sputnik's launch. And what starts to happen there is that with more public funding going into science and with more public attention on science, a lot of stakeholders start to look at science a little more closely and scrutinize the way that grants are being made in the sciences. And so that attention kind of culminated in this 1975 congressional hearing on the peer review process at the National Science Foundation.
So let me see if I'm following correctly. So we decide as a nation that we are behind technologically with the Soviet Union, and therefore we need to invest in science. And so there were a couple decades after Sputnik, you know, including the entire Apollo era, where just massive amounts of money were being poured into universities and institutes to fund science. But by the late 60s or 70s, there's starting to be some accountability questions. Is that what's happening?
Yes, exactly. And the accountability questions, they start slowly and they come from a couple of different eras. In the mid-1960s, for example, the NIH, National Institutes of Health, they kind of get called out for the way that they allow grant accounting to be done. Essentially, they just wrote checks and trusted the people who'd applied for the grant to spend the money the way they said they would, but it came out that a lot of NIH grantees weren't necessarily spending their money on allowable expenses. So, for example, there was one case where an NIH grant recipient had spent some of the money to recruit new employees and renovate their offices. And it didn't seem like that was intentional fraud, but those weren't expenses that were technically allowed. And so Congress started scrutinizing the scientific spending of organizations like the NIH and the NSF more closely. There also started to be some questions about whether investment in science was getting us what we wanted. And specifically, the Department of Defense issued this report called the Project Hindsight Report, in which they found that spending on applied science had yielded a lot of great new weapons advances. But they felt that spending on basic science, just research questions that were of scientific importance, whether or not they had an immediate practical application, the Department of Defense found that that spending had not yielded the kinds of advances they were hoping for. And so they started to question whether or not they should continue to fund science at kind of that post-Sputnik level. And then in the 1970s, there was a period of real economic hardship in the U.S., and there was a lot of pressure on the government to cut taxes, cut spending. And I think that really, that combination of factors really put the sciences in congressional crosshairs in the 1970s.
I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, but it is a little bit disheartening to think that this may be an oversimplification, but science that leads to weapons that we can launch and explode is valuable, but other kinds of science Congress doesn't see as in the 1970s as valuable.
And I think a lot of scientists felt the same way, that they had really felt like this was a moment when the American public was investing in science and passionate about science and willing to let scientists kind of run with their scientific imaginations and explore the mysteries of the universe. So I think for a lot of scientists, it was a rude awakening to have the Department of Defense say, okay, well, that's great, but where are our weapons?
So how did this then, sense that, you know, when Congress decided that all this money going into from the NHS and from Department of Defense and all these other scientific funding places, when they decided, okay, there needs to be some accountability, is that when our modern peer review system developed into what it is, and how did that happen, or what's the connection with peer review there?
So the connection with peer review is an interesting one. Essentially what happens is that Congress says we need more oversight of the money that we are spending on scientific research. We think Congress should be able to weigh in on what kinds of grants go to scientific researchers. The scientific community really pushed back against that. And the way they did that was by elevating peer review from something that, you know, journals could or could not do depending on whether they thought it worked for them, to something that absolutely had to happen in order for science to be legitimate. And so scientists started saying that the peer review process is absolutely essential to science. Only qualified scientists are able to tell good science from bad science. So this question of congressional oversight is really a corruption of science itself. So in essence, they kind of took a process that up to that point had been kind of optional for journals and funding bodies, and they elevated it into something that absolutely had to be there in order for science to work properly. So peer review was kind of the defense against what they saw as an attack on scientific autonomy.
So they essentially, scientists as a community, essentially said, don't watch us because we're watching ourselves with this peer review. And was it universally adopted? I mean, were there a few scientists that were in front of Congress saying, you know, oh, no, we're going to use peer review and therefore you don't have to watch us? And everyone in the scientific community went along with it, or was there ever a period of resistance or where, you know, not everyone necessarily agreed that that was the way to go?
So interestingly, William Carey, who was at that time the head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in his congressional testimony, he said that he thought that that view of peer review was asking way too much of peer review, that he thought that it wasn't reasonable to ask anonymous reports from three or more referees to flawlessly distinguish good science from bad science. But a lot of people in the scientific community really felt persuaded by this vision of peer review as something essential, central to the scientific process. So there wasn't as much pushback as you might expect, despite the fact that this was a pretty major shift in the way that the scientific community conceptualized peer review and what it was for.
Well, you are listening to Lost in the Stacks, and we're going to talk more with Melinda Baldwin about that peer review shift, past, present, and future, on the left side of the hour.
Hi, this is Crow Camera in Vancouver, British Columbia. You are listening to Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta. Don't you just feel silly when you say your own name like that on radio?
Yeah. Yes.
Today's Lost in the Stacks is called Peer Review and the Cold War. Peer review is what we use to validate science, and yet itself, it is not a scientifically tested or proven process. That's an understatement. Scientists, academics, and researchers, for a large part, simply trust that it works. Richard Smith, chief executive of United Health Europe, puts it this way in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine. Smith writes, "One difficult question is whether peer review should continue to operate on trust. I cannot see journals moving beyond trust in any major way unless the whole scientific enterprise moves in that direction. So peer review is a flawed process, full of easily identified defects with little evidence that it works. Nevertheless, it is likely to remain central to science and journals because there is no obvious alternative. And scientists and editors have a continuing belief in peer review. How odd that science should be rooted in belief." Okay, well, that's a real Zen koan right there at the end. So while you're thinking about that, you may file this set under D843.W635.
Just heard Low Fidelity by Lo-Fi Legs, before that was Awfully Managed Pigeons by Procedure Club. Those are some songs about bad management and longing for the way things were in the 70s.
We're back. This is Lost in the Stacks, and we are talking about the history of peer review with our guest Melinda Baldwin. And Melinda, we've been talking about the history of peer review, and I suppose what I really should say is we've been talking about the history of peer review in the United States. We talked about how it was affected by the Cold War and what happened when, you know, as the Cold War went along and Congress wanted some more accountability in the U.S. system. But at the same time that the United States peer review process was evolving into what we see today, what were other countries around the world doing with respect to peer review?
So one of the really interesting things about the history of peer review is the extent to which refereeing really emerged in Anglophone countries, in the U.S. and in Great Britain. So in Germany, for example, which published a lot of the most important 19th century scientific journals, editorial decisions were made by members of the editorial board. They were made by people like Max Planck, who was the editor of the Annalen der Physik when Einstein was active. And so actually, when Einstein moved to the U.S., the peer review process that journals like Physical Review were using was kind of a shock to him, and he was quite offended by the idea that the editor would send his paper out for review by an external expert. Kind of in his view, the editor had sent his paper to a competitor without his permission, and he was very offended and never published in the Physical Review again.
Well, did he think that he was being, like that would... his work would be scooped? Was that his concern?
Yeah, he was concerned that his work would be scooped, and he just didn't understand the purpose of an editor who was supposed to be the person making the editorial decisions sending his paper out to an anonymous expert who was writing down their comments. I mean, from Einstein's point of view, he didn't know who that person was. He didn't know if he should value their opinion or not. It was just unsigned comments by someone who might be trying to work on a competing theory.
So I think now most international journals do employ some sort of a peer review process similar to what we see in the United States. So how did they get from, you know, the irritation that, you know, like Einstein and Planck experienced sending, you know, their work to other anonymous readers? How did we get from there to other countries, you know, kind of having the same system that we see in the United States today?
That's a great question. Essentially, what's happening is that during the Cold War, the American scientific enterprise was so massive that as peer review became required for scientific respectability in the United States, that ended up having a ripple effect on the international scientific community. So, for example, in Britain for a long time, they kind of stuck to the model where the editors were decision makers, and if they solicited referee reports, it was to help advise the editor. It wasn't really to legitimize the science in the paper. So, for example, in 1989, the British medical journal The Lancet ran a really interesting editorial in which they told their readers that the United States was asking way too much of peer reviewers, and that at The Lancet, it was the editors who made the decisions, and the reviewers were just advisors. And so that's 1989, that kind of skeptical view of the utility of peer review, which I think is really remarkable. But because peer review was adopted in the U.S. and because the U.S. scientific community was so enormous, and because so many people were going to the United States for graduate training, eventually that American view of the importance of peer review gets adopted pretty internationally.
So I think you mentioned in your paper that scientists are frustrated, U.S. and globally, that peer review, I think the exact quote is, peer review does not instantly reward innovative papers with publication in a top journal. So those, you know, original questions that some scientists had about peer reviews, there might be some validity there.
I think so, or I think that a lot of scientists working today get frustrated with the peer review process. If you go on academic Twitter, for example, people are always cracking jokes about reviewer two. So it's common practice for editors to send you the nicest report as reviewer one, and then the meanest report as reviewer two. But a lot of people feel like the peer review process doesn't always yield helpful feedback on papers, and that it tends to favor established ideas and people over more innovative, sort of more innovative tracks in scientific research.
So do we need to have some sort of reckoning with peer review if it was, you know, molded into the system that it is today just to, as a way to avoid further congressional oversight? A, did our system of peer review actually succeed in that mission? And B, do we need to do anything else instead?
So I think that the idea that there is a robust system in place within science itself that vets the quality of scientific papers and grant applications, I think that actually has been enormously useful. for the scientific community. I think it is important to be able to go to Congress and say, we have procedures in place that take a very close look at what's being published, what's being funded. We take a careful look at the quality of the science, at the background of the person asking for all this money. Essentially, we can handle this on our own. We've got a system in place for doing it. So I think there is a lot of utility in that. I think where peer review tends to get tripped up is when we expect it to do things that it wasn't necessarily designed to do. So for example, there's often a lot of frustration that peer review doesn't detect fraud, that when an article is retracted, oftentimes observers will say something like, well, why wasn't that caught during the peer review process? What kind of peer reviewers did this journal find? They might have found very good ones, but the assumption that a peer reviewer goes in with is that the work that they're reading is being accurately represented. So essentially, they start with an assumption of good faith on the part of the author. And so peer review is actually very bad at detecting deliberate fraud.
So I want to ask, in the few, we got about half a minute left in this segment, what, as an academic, and someone who has published in the academic literature, what is your experience of being either peer reviewed or being a peer reviewer?
My own experience has been, on the whole, tremendously positive. I've been lucky to get reviewers who take the time to give me constructive feedback, even if they think there's a problem with the article. And I always feel the comments that I've gotten are aimed towards making my work better. And so I'd love to see some broader training in academia that encourages everyone to bring that kind of attitude towards their peer review reports. Because I know that I've talked to colleagues who have gotten reports that just kind of tear down their article and don't really engage with what they're trying to do. And so I'd like to see more collegiality in peer review.
We have been speaking today with Dr. Melinda Baldwin. She is a senior editor at the publication Physics Today, and she's also a science historian and author of the article Scientific Autonomy, Public Accountability, and the Rise of Peer Review in the Cold War, United States. Melinda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
File the set under RA399.A1G76. You just heard Nobody Move, Nobody Get Hurt by Yellow Man. Before that was Complication by the Monks. Those are some songs about increasing complexity and accountability.
Our show today was called Peer Review and the Cold War.
We talked about how the Cold War, specifically the space race between the United States and Russia, influenced the creation of the peer review system now used in academic research grants and journal publishing.
Melinda Baldwin explained the historical scholarly communication context of the early 20th century and how the peer review system evolved in response to scrutiny of federal science funding by the U.S. Congress in the 1970s.
Peer review was not designed to play the role that it currently does, validating all academic work. But hey, have you got any better ideas?
I wonder if they do. You know, if there was a listener who had a better idea, I bet you it would be great if we got, like, an email or a call or, you know, hey, find the address of the station and send us a postcard. Let us know. Okay, roll the credits while we're thinking about that.
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WRIK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library, produced by Charlie Bennett, Amit Doshi, Wendy Hagemeyer, and Fred Rasko.
Matthew was our engineer today, and the show was brought to you in part by the USSR Academy of Sciences.
Holy cow.
Legal counsel and comments from reviewer number two were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Melinda for being on the show, and thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
Find us online at lostinthestacks.org, and you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and plenty of other places we don't even know about.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, it's Plan S. What is it? Where did it come from? Why did Ed Wood direct it?
It came from outer space.
Oh,
Europe. It's time for our last song today. Our current concept of peer review was shaped ultimately as a consequence of events that happened over 60 years ago. And those consequences are still reverberating today. So we close with a song about the Cold War and how the consequences of the Cold War resonate down through the years. This is The Temptation of Adam by Josh Ritter, right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, everybody.